Hello, friends. Lulav here, from such episodes as Vayera, colon, your only episode, which you love. And also, not this episode. Just wanted to put out a PSA to any fellow podcasters to keep several gigabytes of open hard drive space on your recording device, because otherwise your recordings will rapidly degrade in quality. For the general listener, my only message is this. Sorry about the audio quality on this episode and some parts of episode 9. We've identified the issue and are back on track in episode 10 with that crisp, clear audio that you've come to expect. Enjoy the show.
Hi, listeners. Jazz here. We have a little bit of a break from our usual format. Lulav is on vacation, and I thought it'd be boring to just have me, so I brought you some guests. Our first guest, Betty Twersky, is the vice president of the Hewlett Foundation, where she supports the foundation's president in managing special initiatives, and she also leads the foundation's effective philanthropy group. She also serves on the board for the Center for Effective Philanthropy, and she is the founding chair for the Fund for Shared Insight, and she has also previously worked at Yad HaNadiv in Jerusalem, advising them on issues of strategy and organization. Before that, she spent 4 years at the Gates Foundation, designing the Impact Planning and Improvement Division. She was also a founder of BTW Informing Change, a consulting firm, and she holds 2 bachelor's degrees in Middle Eastern Studies and Rhetoric from UC Berkeley and a master's degree in City Planning from MIT. In case you're like, Jazz, who is this person really, and why do you have them, and why do they have your last name? Mama, would you like to say hello?
Hello, it's great to be here, Jazzaru.
Hi. So this is my mom, who I invited on my podcast so that she could talk about Judaism with me. But in case you're like, Jazz, I heard you have 2 moms. Well, we have another bio for you. Jill Blair has worked as a researcher, analyst, advocate, coach, consultant, social entrepreneur, and business owner. Her passion and skills are in helping organizations and their leaders build a healthy, joyful, creative, values-based culture and using information and experience to achieve meaningful results. She spent a year with the Peninsula Jewish Community Center in the Bay Area as a senior fellow for strategy and organizational effectiveness. And in the spring of 2019, her story about that year, New Leader, Endless Possibility, was published by the Ford Foundation of New York. I forgot that you named it that. In addition to her passion for all things Jewish, Jill is deeply dedicated to democratic practice and launched 2 nonprofit philanthropic affinity groups to organize around national service and civic engagement, the Grantmaker Forum on Community and National Service, and PACE, Philanthropy for Active Civic Engagement. She was a founding partner of Informing Change, a consulting firm for nonprofit and philanthropic organizations and leaders. Since 2007, she has been an independent consultant working with a variety of influential organizations. She also serves on the board of trustees of the Gideon Hauser Jewish Day School in Palo Alto, California, and as a mentor for the Scoop Jackson Leadership Fellows in Seattle. Also, you wrote Jill all over your bio, and I kept cutting it because I don't want to call you that. So this is my mom, Lily, and that's what I'm going to call her.
Hi, Jazz.
Hi. Can you say hello to my listeners, too?
Hi, listeners. I'm really happy to be here.
As you can tell from my parents' very long bios, they're very accomplished and cool, and we have a lot to live up to. And so, but when I say we, David Nathan, they can't see that. You have to say hello with your voice.
Hello.
David Nathan Twersky is a first year in college at the University of Chicago. He has many talents in art and science and talking about texts, and is also my favorite and only brother. When I told him I was going to have our parents on an episode, he said, "What about me?" And then he followed up with, "I guess I'm not queer for your Kosher Queers podcast, but I'm part of the family, so it's like I'm culturally queer." So I agree, and that's why he's here.
Hello, happy to be here. Also, I'm the rubber duck enthusiast of the family, so important bio component.
You're right, I forgot to add it. I'm so glad all of you are here.
It's great to be here, Jazz. Thank you.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least 2 Jews and generally more than 3 opinions. Each week, we bring you queer takes on Torah. I'm Jazz, and this is my whole family. And today, we're talking about Parashat Vayishlach. Also, David Nathan volunteered to do our 1 minute summary of this parsha.
Yes, I'm so ready.
Ready, all right, count set, me. Go.
32, Jacob prepares to meet Esau. He sends messengers to Esau who return to tell Jacob that Esau is on his way with 400 men. Jacob is concerned that Esau is preparing to attack, so he splits his group into two camps so at least one will be able to escape. Jacob selects a bunch of animals as gifts to appease Esau and sends them on ahead. Jacob spends the whole night wrestling with an angel who dislocates Jacob's hip and renames him Israel. 33, Jacob meet and embrace, but not before a lot of frustration from Jacob. 34, one of the Hivites rapes Jacob's daughter, but then wants to marry her so badly that he offers to pay any price. Jacob's son, being angry about the violation of their sister, agreed that she will marry him only if all the men in the town are circumcised, which they are, and then Jacob's sons come and slaughter them all. 35, Jacob purges his household of alien gods, goes to Bethel, and builds an altar there, and is renamed Israel again. Jacob journeys onward, and Deborah, Rachel, and Isaac die. 36, Esau has hella descendants. Time.
That was pretty good.
We were so prompt.
Okay, we'll go through it a little more slowly this time. I will do the longer version of that summary. And you'll all interrupt me with questions and discussion, and then we can talk about it?
Yes.
Sounds good.
Great. So we return with Jacob is going to see his brother Esau, and he tells messengers to go ahead and talk to his brother. And the messengers come back to Jacob and say, Esau's coming towards you, and there are 400 men with him. Jacob is frightened, and so he divides up his party so that they will be two camps. We have questions so far. Lily, you brought something up earlier about this part.
Yes, there were a couple of things that struck me about this. They're on the road to see each other. And in the version that I read, it described Jacob as sending angels ahead of him to meet up with his brother Esau. And that the angels returned to Jacob to say, we came to him and he's coming with a lot of people. 400, actually. And the angels didn't say that those 400 were soldiers, and yet Jacob panicked. Mm-hmm. And that there were two things about that that struck me. One was that these were angels in this translation, although I saw in another translation they were just messengers. And what was the significance of them being angels versus messengers? And the other was that there was nothing that implied that they were combatants. And yet Jacob was so ready for a battle that he panicked over the possibility that what Esau was doing was preparing for a fight.
Mm. Why do you think that he panicked about it?
Well, I think I used the word project at one point, and everybody kind of looked at me, that he was projecting. But I don't know. Like, Jacob himself was traveling with quite a gaggle. So he was traveling with a gaggle, presumably not to have a fight with his brother, but to meet up with his brother. And yet when he heard that his brother was traveling with a gaggle, he made an assumption that his brother was coming to kill him. And I don't know what that means. Like, does it mean that he felt so guilty about his own past that he assumed that there was no way around the possibility that he was going to be murdered? Or that he was himself actually anticipating a fight that he might have initiated.
Mm.
To me, this struck me more as something about assumptions, right? So Esau, when they do meet, accepts Jacob really unhesitatingly and doesn't even want all the gifts that Jacob prepares. And yet, before the meeting, Jacob is so certain that Esau will be angry to some incredible extent that not only does he prepare all these gifts, he is legitimately worried about his whole crew being slaughtered, which of course ends up not even being close to the case, but that assumption was clearly very powerful for him.
Yeah, the only thing I would add here is that it made sense to make that assumption. There was a lot of bad blood between the brothers. They hadn't spoken or had any contact in many years, is our understanding. So the fact that Jacob would be worried, I think, would be a reasonable assumption. And when he heard that Esau was coming with 400 men, whether they were soldiers or not, in those times, probably 400 men connoted soldiers, to me makes sense that he would be worried. One of Jacob's responses and one of the interpretations that we read was to use flattery to endear Esau to him. So he would send a gift and say, please, my master, accept this. He continued to send other gifts with the moniker, my master, my master. In fact, I think in the text he says it 8 times. And that is meant to endear him and soften Esau's heart to him.
He also calls himself your servant Jacob in a similar vein.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me, the idea that he was running away from his family when he left home, that he doesn't know what his reception will be. And we know from his past that he wasn't a particularly warlike person and that he did associate his brother very much with that. Mm-hmm. And so he's afraid. And his reaction is, what can I possibly do to sort of appease him? And that kind of makes sense to me as a reaction. And so the next bit is that he divides up his people. He thinks, well, if my brother attacks one group of my people, the other one will escape. And then he prays, like, deliver me from my brother, that he won't attack me or my people. And then he sends lots of presents to Esau. Goats and rams and sheep, camels and cows. Yeah.
So, Jazz, this was another thing that really struck me. And we listened to some commentary on this, that Jacob did 3 things. He prayed, he flattered, and he presented gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And the commentary really struck me, and it has stayed with me, that Jacob, as pious as he is, didn't actually have 100% confidence that his prayers would work by themselves.
Yeah.
So he was not counting only on God. He was exercising his own agency as well.
Yeah. And we were talking about the idea that, like, your actions also have to make things happen. You can't just rely on God to make things happen.
Well, yeah, and it seems pretty quintessentially Jewish. I always remember what they tell us on Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah times, that you're not allowed to pray for forgiveness until you've already asked the person for forgiveness 3 times. And people are very surprised when they hear that you have to ask them and then ask them again and then ask them a 3rd time before you're even allowed to go to God.
Mm.
I think it's pretty consistent that, like, yeah, you pray, but also you have to take action. Otherwise, your prayer is not really meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And gift giving, I think, was pretty of the culture. I mean, it still is now, but you had to give gifts. If you wanted to pass through someone's land, ask for a favor. I think giving a gift was
like an early bribe.
You could say that. Or you could say it was part of the culture. To give a gift.
Yeah.
Still is true in the Middle East today.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, he sends these gifts in rows, right? He says to the one in front, when my brother meets you and asks, who are you? You shall answer, your servant Jacob's. They are gifts sent to my lord Esau. So that's what you were talking about the flattery. And then he gives very similar instructions to the second one and the third, that they go in rows. And he says, I want my brother to see me last and send, you know, presents and other people first. They phrase it here as, and so the gift went on ahead while he remained in camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the night, sort of sneakily, he takes his close family, his wives and concubines and his children. He crosses the river. And that's when we move into this other bit of, and then he's left alone and wrestles with this person. Is it a man or an angel or a...
Or God.
Yeah. Right. So they wrestle from the middle of the night until dawn. And then the person wrenches his hip, like sprains it.
Mm-hmm.
The person says, let me go. Like, I have to go at daybreak. And Jacob says, I won't let you go. You have to bless me first. And the person says, what's your name? He says, Jacob. And the person says, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with beings divine and human and have prevailed. And then Jacob, or Israel now, asks for the stranger's name, and the stranger does not tell him, and instead leaves.
So I want to note what you just sort of glossed over, which is that he is supposed to be renamed now, and yet they continue to refer to him as Jacob.
Right, it's very rude.
Right. And in fact, later, he is renamed Israel a 2nd time, and they still... sometimes refer to him as Israel and sometimes not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not super clear what the delineation is, why it doesn't count here, and what the whole deal is. So,
well, maybe this is a good queer reference.
Right.
Right? Because when you are transitioning from one identity to another, not everybody is caught up immediately. Sometimes it takes them a little while. Sometimes they'll call him Jacob. Sometimes they'll call him Israel. Sometimes they go back and forth. They get a little confused until they really realize, okay, this dude is Israel.
I like that reading. But I also, it is an interesting thing because they don't have it with Abraham, right? When we have Abraham in the text earlier, who also gets renamed, the text just kind of switches immediately and gets it the first time. And this time they don't.
Why do you think that is, Jez?
I don't have a clear reading, but I was talking about this with the Abraham one earlier, about how it was actually very hard for me, in some respects, to use their older names. When a person gets a new name, you use that name for them, even retroactively. Mm-hmm. Like we were talking about the other night, off mic, of how when I was little, you didn't call me Jazz, but now, even if you said, like, when you were five, you'd refer to me as Jazz, even though that wasn't my name then. And it is very hard for me to switch to people's other names. But even though it's convention for us to refer to Abraham as Abraham, we don't have the same instincts around Jacob and Israel. Right. And I wonder if that's because we become Am Yisrael, and it is very hard for us to think of his name Israel as all of our names.
Yeah. I do struggle with that. When I hear Israel, I do not think, oh, person. I think people, at least.
Right. And now, right, we have a state. And So it's like a whole... I don't know what other people might have done in the past, whether there was a period in history where people reacted differently. Part of what is hard for me is that the text is inconsistent about it, and also we don't hear from him. He's named by somebody else, mm-hmm. and that feels different.
Yeah, it's the same for Abraham and Sarah. I know that the name change is done externally, which I think is really interesting. I don't know if there are other biblical name changes, but at least these ones that I can think of, it's all external.
But actually, as you're saying that, it makes me wonder if the issue of not fully owning the name is part of what we're getting. The name is conferred, and it takes Jacob time himself to even adjust to the new name. And so it gets conferred again. And the interesting thing about the shift for Jacob's name is that it does go from being the name of a person to being the name of a people. Mm-hmm. And that also is related to when God confers the name a second time and says, and you shall give rise to, you know, it's associated with not just an individual any longer, but with the creation of a whole nation. So there's something about the process of ownership, and you can start with, this is where I'm beginning, but it takes you a while to get where you're going. The other thing is, who is it that he is wrestling with?
Right. We were talking about this earlier because you were saying, well, like, it says man here and angel here in your translation. And in the original Hebrew, the first time it mentions it, it does say ish, like a man or a person. It doesn't say, like, malach, like an angel. So originally...
Well, in verse 31, they say Peniel, that's face of God, right?
And that's what Jacob names the place. It's not what...
Like a difference between what the text says and what Jacob says.
Right. Well, but also what the man says is, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with beings divine and human and have prevailed. That's verse 29.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that does suggest that the being is...
Divine.
Mm-hmm. In some way.
Yeah, and then, of course, you wonder, what is the difference between... So I became convinced that it was a divine being because another reading of it was that the being touched his own hip. And when he touched his own hip, Jacob's hip became dislocated. And that is, again, having something acted upon you, and in this case, from a distance, and only a divine being.
How I read it the first time, because... This translation, the Chabad, does a little bit of the pronoun game with a lot of he and he and he, and you never know who it's talking about. I initially read it as Jacob touched the angel's hip and his own hip was dislocated, which I thought was sort of an interesting read.
Right, we have this, when he saw that he could not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and you're like, well, that's a lot of
hip. I have no idea.
To me, when I read this, and I read it a few times, I thought, maybe he's just having a really big anxiety dream. He's about to go meet his brother, who he hasn't seen in years. He had a really bad breakup with. He's worried. He feels compelled to go into the land of Israel. Doesn't really feel prepared. He's about to meet his brother. He doesn't know how it's going to go. He has a really tortured night's sleep. And maybe it's his own anxiety that is tormenting him, and he's thrashing about, and he throws out his hip.
And look at the consequence. It's our first law of kashrut.
It is, yes. Yeah. So then we have this proclamation that that is why we do not eat the thigh muscle that's on the socket of the hip.
I wanted to talk about that, actually, maybe just briefly, which is many of the rules of kashrut, it is my understanding, come from we don't eat that because it's in some way unclean.
Yes.
But this one seems like, well, this was a divine being. The right. divine being touched the hip socket.
Yes.
So that doesn't seem like, why would that make it unclean? This seems to me more of a holy thing. Like, mm-hmm. that's why we don't eat it, because it was touched by divinity.
Right.
Which seems counter to many of the rules of kashrut. So I was wondering what people thought.
Well, and it's also interesting because you don't eat humans anyway. Like,
right.
Yeah, but they apply that to the animals.
Yes, obviously. But it is an interesting thing because, you know, most of the rules that we have on kashrut that come up based on teachings in Leviticus are really only supposed to apply to Jews. And this one is not supposed to just apply to Jews. This one is supposed to apply to everybody. It's considered a Noahide one.
That's interesting because the text here says, therefore the children of Israel may not eat the displaced tendon, which really does make it the first law of kashrut. But just on the issue more generally of kashrut, one of the things I read was, David Nathan, that modern interpretations really don't like to contextualize the laws of kashrut in terms of cleanliness or food safety because they're contextual and temporal. So if you place them in that context, then you can disregard them once they become no longer a hazard. So the first law of kashrut cannot be associated with anything temporal. It is simply a truth that comes from the divine. And it may be that that's the guide for how to take on the future laws of kashrut, that they're not temporal. And even if now pork is no longer dangerous and shellfish is no longer dangerous because of refrigeration, that you still have to abide the laws because fundamentally you may think that they came from something timely, but they really all derive from something divine.
Just to beat this one more time, it is strange how you go from wrestling either with your own anxiety or with an angel of God or with some sublime being that it becomes a law of kashrut. How does that relate to what we should or shouldn't eat? That feels like a big leap.
Mm-hmm. And also,
if you get hit in the face by an angel, would you not eat a face?
I also, just to put this in context of like who all of us are, and also like the name of this podcast is Kosher Queers, like I keep the closest to kosher in that I don't eat certain animals, but you might look at this thing and say it's fascinating that those come up with laws of kashrut, but like you live by the laws of kashrut.
No, but I'm conscious of them.
As you keep what we would call California kosher.
I know.
And you live in New York.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, but you don't do any of them, and you live in California.
Well, I do want to, we probably should move on, but I do want to say that I like your phase interpretation of this actually being kind of a nightmare as opposed to being something that really happened.
Who knows? I mean, we all have vivid dreams, and why do we have them? They're part of our subconscious, but we don't really fully understand our subconscious. So, you know, people have spent time over millennia trying to interpret dreams. So I do think it happens overnight. It is some kind of dream, whether it's a divine intervention dream
yeah.
or a real dream. Sometimes we wake up and say, boy, that felt so real. Mm-hmm. And then we begin to recount it, and it seems so crazy.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And in the next parsha, the next one features Joseph's dreams quite prominently.
Yeah.
So can we move on to the next morning? Looking up, Jacob saw Esau coming, and he has his 400 people. And so then he divides up his children, and he puts Rachel and Joseph in the last group, and Leah and all of her children in the first group. And then he goes and bows to his brother, and then runs to greet him. And Esau sees Jacob's family. And Jacob offers Esau lots of gifts, and Esau has to find them, and Jacob says, no, please take them, and Esau eventually accepts them. And then Esau tries to walk with him and to accompany him. And Jacob says, no, I'm gonna go more slowly than you. We shouldn't go together.
So I'll start on this one because I have a personal association with this part of the story, especially a part that you didn't dwell on in your summary, Jazz. Which so when I was a little girl, my dad, your Zadie, who you only met when you were 2 months old, Jazz, he put me to sleep every night, and he would tell me Bible stories, and this was one of my favorites, and I asked for it again and again, and he always told the stories and he would embellish them a little bit, but this one didn't actually need much embellishing, I realize now, because, he would tell the story of Jacob and Esau and how nervous Jacob was and how he would build up the drama as they were walking across a field towards each other, each one with their reinforcements and so on and so forth, and describing how they were walking and they were nervous and weren't sure what was going to happen. And as they approached one another, they embraced and kissed and hugged. And the moral of the story was the power of sibling and family bonds. Mm-hmm. And I always loved that story, and that's why I asked my dad for it again. And then there's so much drama to it, and yet in the end, there was no warfare. They actually embraced as brothers. And I know more happened after that, but to me, that's my favorite interpretation because it was my dad's interpretation, and it is the one that resonates the most for me.
Hmm. Lovely story. Obviously, I think the family is very important. Mm-hmm. I wonder how it would have resonated for your dad as a person with lots of siblings, to have that be the moral of the story.
My dad did have a lot of siblings.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I promise that when I have a gaggle of 400 soldiers, I won't attack you.
They weren't soldiers.
They were just men.
When you have 400 followers, I want to meet them and ask why they think they're following you.
They'll be my disciples.
Okay, all right.
Well, there is something kind of vivid about when Mama tells the story about hearing it as a child, that you can visualize these two men walking towards each other, and you don't know what's going to happen at the last minute. And in a way, like what it says to me is that we always have a choice. Right up until that moment, they have a choice. They can fight or they can decide to embrace. Mm-hmm. And the choice they make is to embrace, even though in some respects, maybe they were both ready for a fight.
I do think that the part in the beginning, Jazz, that you read, I do think that Jacob, because he was never the fighter that Esau was, he always had to outsmart him. And in some ways, you could say he does that now too. That is, in the way that he gives gifts and continues to give gifts and puts his family out first, his wives and his children and so forth. Whereas Esau's coming with 400 men. We don't know if they're soldiers, but you can imagine that that's the assumption. So Jacob is trying to avoid a fight, and then Esau taps into either because he's persuaded by the gifts, by the family, or some, filial bond.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the next chapter, actually, we're led to believe that Esau really didn't expect these things and wasn't preparing for a fight.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm looking at...
Well, this is the same chapter. It's still in 33.
Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have remain yours. So he sort of says, you didn't need to bring me gifts. And Jacob keeps, begging to give him gifts. Mm-hmm. And Esau is basically saying, it's not necessary, and you don't need to call me your master. And in fact, let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. Mm-hmm. Notwithstanding what you just said, that Esau is the fighter and Jacob is not, that Esau really does present here with a lot of kindness and a lot of generosity.
Although my understanding of that line of let me leave some of them there with you is that Jacob interpreted that as a threat. That he says, do not do that, and he doesn't want to stay with his brother's people, and he has them go separately, and so. Can we talk about the next story?
Yeah, keep going.
So the next story is this kind of upsetting one. We don't have a lot about their daughters, but this parsha is about Dinah, one of Leah's daughters, and this man, Shechem, who is of one of the neighboring towns, rapes her and then asks to marry her. Jacob hears about it and waits till his son comes home, and the sons come in and are very, very upset. And Shechem's father, Hamor, comes and asks for Dinah's hand in marriage and asks that Jacob, that they intermarry a lot. Asks for Dinah to be married to them and then asks for Jacob's sons to marry There's more to that story, but I'm going to pause there unless you'd like me to finish.
Yeah, I had a number of questions about this one. One of the first that came up was, why does he so extensively want to marry her? Because they agree for all of the men in the town to be circumcised, and then while the men are all, you know, in horrible pain, they are slaughtered, all of them. And so, clearly, it's a heavy price. Like, presumably they don't think they're going to be slaughtered, but they agree to circumcise themselves, which is a heavy price. And they basically agree on the basis of this one guy so desperately wants to marry Dina, who he has just raped.
I thought that there was a little bit of an implication because his father goes to ask for it. So it's not just Shechem, but also Hamor, who's interested in this and says, not just my son wants to marry your daughter, but can you marry our daughters as well? And that he's part of this neighboring town, and we know that Jacob comes with wealth, that my impression was in some ways that this was supposed to be cementing of a political alliance, that he is interested in her partially because it gives him access to power.
I thought that was right too. And also Shechem was the son of Hamor, who was the chief of the country.
Yes.
So it wasn't just any old guy.
Yeah. Well, but I just wanted to say in terms of, yes, presumably there was some political and power alliance, but also the text is Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite chief of the country, saw her and took her and lay with her by force. Being strongly drawn to Dina, daughter of Jacob, and in love with the maiden, he spoke to the maiden tenderly. So Shechem said to his father, get me this girl as a wife. So Hamor may have then decided, well, this is an opportunity to get a lot of clout,
right,
with, you know, this guy who has a bunch of sheep and camels. But the initiation is that this guy rapes Dina and then, for whatever reason, becomes so attached, the text says in love, that he goes to his father and asks for her as a wife. So he is really the initiator of this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like Jazz's interpretation and Mama's affirmation of it, but I'm kind of with David Nathan that really what started this was Shechem's attraction to Dina. What's troubling, of course, about this part of the story is that we're being told that you can love and rape at the same time, and that's like a terrible message. And there's something, it's not quite in the text, but you can't help but read this and feel that Dina kind of is going along with it. Because in the end, they have to take her from his house. When the brothers come back and slaughter the village, they remove Dina from his house. So she's in the house with him. And it kind of is icky. It leaves me feeling not good about it.
Well, obviously, the whole situation is very gross.
Yeah.
We don't hear from her at all, though.
So we don't hear her. She doesn't have a voice.
Yeah, we don't know that she's going along with it. She may just be captive.
Yeah, yes. I don't see where you're getting she was in his house.
She is, because after they slaughtered everybody, they went and got her.
Where yeah, in 34:27, they put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword, took Dina out of Shechem's house, and went away.
Right. Yeah, 26, yeah.
Two different possible interpretations jump out at me. Obviously, there could be more, but one of them is that they clearly do not want to be intermarried, and it seems like it is a possible interpretation that she's in his house, that it was a thing that she wanted, that there was some attempt of choosing to join a neighboring group. But obviously, that is counteracted by the bit that it says that there's force, you know, but it seems possible that there is some interpretation in which this would have been her choice had her brothers not
right. Killed everybody. Okay, so then the last two things that struck me here was, one is that notwithstanding that they didn't want to intermarry, the implication is that Jacob's sons, that they plundered the city and they took the wives.
Right.
So they committed the same act upon the women in the town.
Right.
That was acted upon their sister, and that Jacob was ashamed of them. Thereupon Jacob said to Simeon and to Levi, "You have troubled me to discredit me among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites, and I am few in number, and they will gather against me, and I and my household will be destroyed." So Jacob is both ashamed and also He's saying, what have you done? Like, now you put us more at risk again.
Well, I also read that and was interested by it. This portion that you just read, and then the next line is, they answered, should our sister be treated like a harlot? My question is he speaking righteously or selfishly, right? Mm. Is it about, I can't believe you've just slaughtered this whole village. It's unjustified and you've done something wrong. Or is it more about, you've made them angry, now I'm unsafe, and that was the main concern, and their reacting is, geez, you don't even care about your daughter, man? Like, what's happening here?
It's just so, like, nobody, as far as I can tell in this narrative, listens to Dina ever.
Yeah.
Right. I guess that's part of why I'm not, it doesn't feel to me like a likely interpretation, and I don't mean to downplay what happened to her, but I guess it's part of why I'm looking for some explanation that gives her some amount of agency, because nobody listens to her, like, not Shechem certainly, but also not her brothers or her father. Like, there is no...
Well, nobody asks.
Right.
Yeah, we don't hear her voice once, I don't think.
No, we don't know if Shechem is listening or not. We don't know if anybody's listening. We don't know if she's saying anything.
Right.
So we have to be careful not to just project what we would say.
Mm. Right, but everybody else does speak. Shechem speaks, Hor speaks, and her brother speaks, and her father speaks, and she doesn't speak. So we do have that amount of information.
And the men actually are pretty self-interested about their own reputations. So the brothers, you could say they're worried about her reputation, but it also seems like they're worried that somehow that rape is bringing dishonor to them.
Right.
And the same thing with Jacob, where he's worried that the attack of the town is bringing dishonor to him.
Mm.
So they're worried about their honor. It seems like maybe even a little bit more than they're worried about Dina.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with that. I completely agree with it.
Yeah. So the next bit is a little bit. God says to Jacob, go to Bethel and remain there and build an altar. And Jacob says, like, be purified, get rid of alien gods, like idols in your house, to all of the people in his group. And they go and they build an altar, and nobody else pursues them. It says a terror from God fell on the cities round about, and he builds an altar, and Rebecca's nurse dies, and then God names him again.
Mm-hmm.
And God gives Godself another name and says, I am El Shaddai, which I believe is the first time God uses that name. And then God says, you shall be a nation, and the land that I gave will be for you as well and for your descendants. So it's the same blessing ancestors give. Then Rachel is in childbirth and gives birth to Benjamin, and then she dies, and they bury her.
Where do they bury her, Jazz?
In Bethlehem.
In Bethlehem.
I just asked that because, of course, that is a source of current modern tension.
Of having her grave there and also it being such a Christian site?
Yes.
And in the West Bank.
Mm.
So, I had a question about the beginning part, which is the part with the alien gods, because a few things. One is, in the text, God never tells Jacob to purify and get rid of alien gods. So that is Jacob's idea, but these are the people in his group. So he's had them for a while, and I guess they've just never done this before? Like, they were carrying around alien gods before?
Well, so you didn't read this portion because I only asked you to read this one, but a couple parshas ago, I think actually in the last parsha, they flee from his uncle Laban's house, and Rachel brings with her the gods of Laban's household and steals them and hides them. And so I think there is the implication that she still has them with her, which is an interesting thing also because that is his favorite wife of all of the four women that he is with. We don't have explicit reference to anybody else having
again
deities.
A queer reference is when you're transitioning from many gods to one god, you take some time to accommodate that transition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but it's interesting, given the context elsewhere in the Bible, where they are very virulently anti-idol, very strongly and very passionately. So, A, it's interesting that God still favors this guy, even though he is bringing with him and in his group all these false gods. And then what I thought was interesting is he collects them. He says, purify yourselves. And then instead of destroying them, he buries them.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't destroy them.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting and counter to what happens elsewhere in the story.
Mm.
It felt to me a little bit actually like an interesting reflection. Because you're right, David Nathan, that later on they get more stridently anti-idol. And this one feels to me like we're not a nation yet, you know? We're still just a family. And they're an intermarried family. You know, they're a family where these aren't just like the gods of the neighboring nation. They're his uncle's gods and the gods that his wife grew up with. And it is a different type of thing of, you know, how do we build unconventional families? Families that have like lots of different nuances and complicated family dynamics. And that feels a little bit more of like a thing that might be going on to me.
And when you say it like that too, the burial of the deities rather than the destruction of them is a little like what happens when... We know of families where the way that they deal with someone who stepped outside of the family in some way is that they grieve them, they mourn them as though they've died, rather than, you know, it's just a kind of metaphor for mm-hmm. the distance that you put between you and your own family.
Mm-hmm.
Tragically. I know we only have a few minutes left, and I need to say two things here. One is that I was struck, and God said to him, I am the Almighty God, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a multitude of nations shall come into existence from you. And two things hit me about this. One is the concept of nation sounds so strong, and we have this whole Torah that tells us that, you know, we are going to be a nation. And we've always been like on the margins. So just to say that we've never quite fulfilled that promise. And also among a multitude of nations, it hit me that that is the diaspora, that what we've given rise to is not just a nation that is a powerful nation, but also a multitude of nations within other nations, which felt to me like the diaspora.
Yeah. We actually have to move on because there's one last thing I want to talk about, and then we have to make room for our ending segment. But our last thing in the text that I wanted to see if anybody wanted to talk about was in that same area. We go back to the name Israel, and when Israel stayed in that land, his oldest son, Reuben, went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. Israel found out, and it said, now the sons of Jacob were 12 in number, and which means he takes Bilhah's son, even though it is not his own son, it is his
son's son.
To be
his own son.
And yeah.
That's the 12th tribe.
Yes.
And that was shocking to me. Like, I did not realize that. I mean, it doesn't say it explicitly because what we know is that Reuben slept with her. And then the next thing we hear is, and now Jacob has 12 sons. Did you guys know that?
Yeah, that's what it says.
But did you know it before you had said it? I mean, it just was, it's interesting.
It is interesting to me. And interesting also, you know, when we think about parentage, that, you know, I had never heard of anything in the Torah before. I had not remembered this or hadn't heard it before. But interesting to me because so much of the Torah, like the rest of this Parsha, is a long list of genealogies. And we keep very close track of genealogies and who's the child of who. And, you know, sometimes we go in modern times into more conservative settings and they're very much like, well, and who is your birth parent and who are you the child of? And we track you matrilineally. And this is a little bit of a break from it. And so actually is this whole notion of Bilhah and Zilpah, because earlier on, Leah and Rachel say to their maids to have children with them because it's like claiming their own children before they have children. And it's almost like a biblical precedent for adoption.
Exactly.
Does Jacob have a son already before this bit?
Jacob has
lots of sons.
Reuben is his oldest son.
Right, I know. But when you count up the names of his sons, there's 11 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so where's the 12th one?
Well, is Benjamin in this list?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's Rachel's son. I don't know.
The 12th son is either Dan or Naphtali.
No, because if you 11. Count up the names, there's 11 of them.
Oh, so we don't know.
We don't maybe get his name.
We don't get his name.
But did he... Because it says he lay with Bilhah, and now they were 12 in number. and then lists 11 names and says, these are the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. So did he have one already?
No, there's 12, David Nathan. There's Reuben, then there's Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, and then Gad and Asher. That's 12. That's 12, 12 children.
Yeah. Oh, I missed Reuben.
Yeah, there you go.
Whoops. The last bit, I believe, is just genealogies. So unless you have something else to say about genealogies.
Nope.
Anything to say about genealogies?
No, we're good, Jess.
I think we're ready to move on to our next and last segment.
And our next and last guest.
Yeah. Lenny B, would you come join us? For this last segment, we're going to move on to rating God's writing, in which we rate the Parsha on scales we just came up with to say how good we think it is. And for this segment, I'm going to be joined by another family member, my Aunt Lenny B, Lynn Blair. Can you say hello to the people?
Hello, people. I'm Lenny B. Blair.
I think we can go in a circle. So ask questions this way. Who would like to start?
What are we rating on?
You are going to come up with your own scale. I can start if you would like.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Lily, on a scale of 12 sons who make up 12 tribes, how many sons would you rate this? Oh, sorry.
Well, I would rate it a 10 because I thought it was a very rich parsha. It had lots and lots of interesting twists and turns and things to think about. So I give it 10 sons.
Great. Now you have to ask them on that
scale. Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10 goats, how many goats would you give this parsha?
Okay, wait, question about your scale.
Yes.
Are they he-goats or she-goats?
There's 7 she-goats and 3 he-goats.
Okay.
I was hoping they were zygotes.
Lily, thank you for that question. I'm going to abstain from a rating. The whole idea of rating the Parsha is hard for me to do. I think maybe it's too ingrained in me from an early age that the Torah is a sacred thing, hard to rate, hard to understand. So I'm going to, if your scale includes an N-A, which best practice would suggest it would, I'm going to take an N-A.
I think that means that scale passes on to you, David Nathan.
Okay. What was it, 10 goats?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think I would just keep the 7 she-goats. And I'd lose the 3 he-goats. I thought it was very interesting, good to pick apart, although I did think that some twists kind of came out of no place and then didn't receive further explanation and was a little bit shocked. So when it says, and he came to town and his daughter was raped,
yeah.
That was a little like, boy, I've just been whacked in the face. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, but it was pretty good.
That's why your face isn't kosher.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Lily kind of stole my idea. On a scale of 0 to 30 milk camels, how many camels would you give this portion?
Oh, well, let's see. Let's see. On a scale of 0 to 30 camels, I would give it 20 to 24 camels.
Okay.
Two things really affected me, one positively and one quite negatively. I really enjoyed the talk about forgiveness and asking for it 3 times before praying to God. I found that very inspiring. I have to say, from when I read the Parsha for the first time today and then hearing you discuss it, I'm extremely uncomfortable with the killing of all the men in town. And the word that really came to me right away when I read it and I heard you discussing it was the word overkill.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is really where we get that from, mm-hmm. because if in fact they were so angry and so indignant and so self-righteous, I guess they could have just killed the man that raped you.
Yeah.
But to kill all those men after having them circumcised felt to me in very not in good faith.
And by the way, they made them wait for 3 days in pain before they
not killed. Good. Okay, yeah. So as I say, maybe I should lower that to 20 milk camels, but I really enjoyed today's portion.
Great. So we're going to wrap up. Thank you all so much for being here.
Before we go formally to the outro, one of the things, Mama, that you made me aware of is that normally I talk about the land that we're on and the indigenous peoples who are here and kind of speed past that bit.
Mm-hmm.
We're recording over Thanksgiving and we're recording in a new place from where I usually record. So I thought, you know, it'll make us a little bit long, but maybe we could talk a little bit about who was here.
Mm-hmm.
So I did some research. We're recording this audio and this podcast today on the traditional lands of the Kashaya people, who are a group of indigenous people from the Homo group, which includes a number of different tribes. And they're actually very, very near here. And there is a small reservation that still exists near here, but it has under 100 people living on it. And we know that at sort of the height of this group's existence, there were about 8,000 people who spoke the language. And now there's only a few dozen people who do.
Mm-hmm.
That what's now California was one of the most linguistically diverse regions ever. And it is not anymore. The majority of those languages are not spoken anymore.
Yeah.
So I just thought that it would be nice for us acknowledging, like, that's the history you were talking about, diaspora,
mm-hmm.
like, that this was and still is somebody else's homeland, and that's where we're recording today.
Thank you, Jazz, for sharing that with us. I do think it's important to honor where we are in the history of the place, and in particular where we are, it feels like a very holy place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to honor the Kashaya, whose land this has been and still is.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jazz.
Thank you, Jazz.
Thank you.
And thanks for having us on your podcast.
Thank you. All right. And for our listeners, thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. You can also follow us on Twitter at kosherqueers, or like us on Facebook at kosherqueers, or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com. Our artwork is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. And our sound production is done by my lovely co-host, Lulav Arnau, who is not here this week, but will still dutifully edit all of our audio. As usual, I'm Jazz Twersky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. And have a lovely queer Jewish day.
This week's gender is an abundance of mothers.
This week's pronouns are she, her, and hers.